Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel #LinuxShow. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
And we're back.
It's The Linux Show. We are back. It is the 21st of October. We are doing our last full official show for the month of October. We will be back next week. Don't worry, we're not completely disappearing. We are going to be having our special annual show for Halloween. Make sure you check out the website, www.thelinuxshow.com, during the course of the week for news. In years past, we've had trivia contests, online scavenger hunts. What was it, a year or 2 years ago, we had a gaming event. It just depends upon what we feel like the week before, what we're going to set up. You'll find out next week what we're setting up for our annual Halloween show, but there will be some kind of prizes for those of you who do show up and attend. So make sure you do for our annual event of fun and frolic on Halloween week. So check us out back then, but we will have a regular show tonight, as well as regular shows throughout the month of November. Got a number of guests already lined up for November. Got a great guest lined up for tonight. He was actually supposed to be our guest last week, but ended up being on an airplane, and so we had to reschedule him. So here we are. It's October the 21st, 2003, and we're launching another episode of The Linux Show. Ironically, I was just talking a couple of things in those maintenance type issues that we talk about from time to time, either at the beginning or the end of the show. One of the people was commenting in the IRC before the show that the sound sounds good to them tonight because their cable company has increase their download speed. I just thought some of you would be interested in knowing that I have been getting emails during the last couple of weeks as we've been changing things around. A couple of weeks ago, we did have some new cards added to one of our servers and have been testing some new stuff. But people have been telling us over the course of the last couple of weeks that they're actually getting a more solid stream on dial-up than they are through a cable modem connection. Not true on DSL, but for some reason, the cable modem or the cable companies seem to really screw up streamed media for their users, and we're going to have to look into that in a little bit better detail and to find out why dial-up users are having an easier time listening to the Linux show than the people out there listening on cable modems. But, oh well, that's what you get for supporting the cable industry, the evil, evil cable industry.
Aren't cable connections timeshared?
Well, they're all part of one big Ethernet network.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's a daisy. It's kind of like not a T network. I think it's just
your basic, you know, Ethernet network.
Sharing the connection with everybody on your trunk?
Within a given neighborhood.
Yeah.
It could be on one physical segment of a network. So if you've got two people listening to, you know, streamed media that are, you know, both neighbors, of course they're going to be you know, queuing up with the same protocol on the network, and the collision detection of Ethernet is going to give them some minor problems. I would think it would take at least two or three or four people all in the same neighborhood listening to some kind of streamed media content before it has much major effect. But, yeah, who knows? I really haven't been in the offices of a cable company in a couple of years. They seem to not want me in there.
But both modem and DSL, you have a direct line to the router.
In theory, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but that surprised Kevin. You were saying something that you witnessed recently, a side by side test.
Well, this wasn't recently. This was a couple years ago now. But a friend of mine had a cable modem and was getting really awful throughput. So he had a laptop, which he dialed in and was trying to go to the same website on each, and the dial-up was significantly faster.
Yeah. Well, but we can't count that if it's a couple years old. But anyways, for those of you out there that are listening on cable modem, that's probably the reason why you just have too many people in your immediate neighborhood, watching that porno streamed media. Yeah, that's probably the cause. So, anyways, well, let's go ahead and bring everybody in for segment number one. Arnie, you're there. So, how you doing?
Great. Going. It's great.
Well, I should say.
We have four days now, continuous century mark temperatures here. It is bloody hot and miserable.
Really?
Oh, it's like unbelievably hot.
If it's as hot in Santa Barbara as it is here, I mean, it is way over 90 here. So if it's that hot here, gosh knows what it must be.
Well, in Ontario, it's always hotter. At the school in Fontana today, it was 110.
I just want to report that it's coming in fine on my cable modem. That was the interference. Sorry.
Yeah, well, probably none of your neighbors are watching porno.
No, it's not. We're not like that. They're not even watching each other, for your sakes.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, it's hot.
So, glad to have you back, Doc.
Yeah, me too. I'm sorry, I just wasn't in the right place or time the last couple of weeks. It's just, I've been on the road an unbelievable percentage of the time. And a lot of short hauls. I was up at something called Foo Camp, which is for Friends of O'Reilly, which Tim O'Reilly and the folks up there, they put up a kind of a camp out on their new campus where everybody went and played around. I said it was like Burning Man without the gas bill. It was kind of fun, yeah, a lot of fun, actually. And then from there I went to speak at the Enterprise Architect Summit, and then from there to Digital ID World, where I did another talk.
Now, let's back up a second. People were camped out?
Yeah, they were camped out. Yeah. I shared a tent with Dave Ziffrey. It was kind of fun. He picked me up at the airport and we went up there. And, you're just invited to bring along a tent. They have a big lawn behind their new buildings, between the buildings and an orchard. Some people camped out in the orchard, which is cool. And it was like camp out Friday and Saturday night, go home Sunday sometime. And the sessions were whatever anybody felt like putting on, so they just created some big, kind of whiteboard spaces and chopped it up into blocks, and whoever felt like speaking or talking or bringing up a session of some kind in any given room could do it, and just had a lot of fun. Among other things, I found that Brian Bellendorf, the primary father of Apache, is also a rave DJ. He brought along his whole outfit, and we put it out. We broadcast it. Tim Pozar, who's a broadcast engineer as well as one of the heavies in the San Francisco wireless scene, wireless internet scene, managed to put out a stream or a bunch of streams on something or other. And so we were even taking the stream and mixing it back, I think, at some point. It was pretty weird. It was a lot of fun, though.
It's definitely good to have you back.
Thanks.
And, Russ, how are you doing out there on the East Coast tonight?
Well, it's markedly different, apparently, from what guys out west are doing. We're not having any trouble with heat. In fact, the high tomorrow is only supposed to be like in the mid-50s. It is, for the most part, very moderate fall weather out this way. Weather is overall pretty nice. And
you got to be at the peak of the Washington, D.C. color right now.
There's a lot of color out there. There is,
yeah,
definitely.
Probably.
It arrived late this year because summer, the whole thing was bizarre this year. I mean, it was a mild summer and so forth. And so we have a lot of color right about now. That's for anything that all the leaves that didn't get stripped from the trees from the storms that came through, the hurricane and thus far. So forth. So it's interesting. It's nice. Very nice.
Speaking of Washington, D.C., this is just a footnote, and I think Doc will be semi-interested in this. Trying to organize a show that will probably be sometime in either late November or early December, but really unusual. Doc was talking about the Dean campaign a couple weeks ago, and out of the blue, in the same 24-hour period, we got contacted by somebody from the Dean campaign, and this guy, Dr., what's his name? Dr. William Dam from the Republican Party. Both, like, on the same day about reaching out to the geek community. So, really strange that it all happened in the same 24-hour period. So we're going to try and see if we can put together a show. It's going to be a non-political, hopefully, show, just talking about, you know, the efforts that are going on within the parties to reach out to this rather undefined community right now. And I think it's a timely interest of people with all the news, especially going on in the primaries right now. The primaries in the Democratic Party are starting to shape up between, rather than the ideology of the candidate, it's new media versus old media, which I think is a really different kind of thing for them to be focusing on. But I think that'll make for an interesting show in a few weeks' time. But, Kevin, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Got married this weekend.
Yay.
Very good.
Congratulations, Kev.
Try not to do it too often, Kevin.
Yeah.
Yeah, comes the voice of experience.
Yeah, the voice of way too much experience on that one.
Me too.
Yep, okay.
Yeah, if somebody, I think, if a young person is going to make a bad decision in that respect, I'll say, that'll be a good first marriage for you. But I'm sure this will be your only one.
Well, this is the second one already. So.
Oh, second one?
Yep.
Shit, man, you're gaining on me.
Yeah.
Well.
Well.
Hello, everybody. Eric Raymond here.
Eric.
Hey.
Eric.
I've been listening for the last couple of minutes, and boy, you must not have a lot of content for this show if you're all talking about the weather in the Democratic primaries.
Oh, no, we've got plenty of content.
I got some content to offer you. I can plug my book.
That's a good thing.
Actually, Eric, you can, but your publicist has already gotten me a copy of the book to read.
I didn't know that.
And so I'm in the middle of it right now. It's really an unusual book when you look at the name of programming in Unix, and it's got nothing to do with programming. I shouldn't say nothing, but a very interesting book in the perspective that you've put this thing together in.
Well, let's talk about that later. You can mini interview me or something.
Okay, sure, be happy to. But let's go ahead and get the first segment of the show kicked off. Well, Arnie and Doc, it's been a long time, a week for you, Arnie, so why don't you start off tonight?
Yeah, good. you take it, Arnie.
Well, you know, you look through the industry news magazines this week on the net or in print, either way, and just about everything is the 64-bit Windows Server 2003. And they're all hyping it, you know, covers of the magazine, 64-bit Windows under construction from InfoWorld, and they all have Inside Office 2003, eWeek Labs, CRN, they're all featuring, you know, the 64-bit. There's a major article in InfoWorld, the link should be up on the website. And they're talking, they pretty much take it apart. And basically the bottom line is they have a list of things that are not implemented yet. And it's pretty substantial. .NET doesn't work, and where is this? Okay. It's basically their, here we go. .NET Framework, UDDI, Microsoft Meta Directory Services, Hot Ad Memory, Network Bridge, Windows Media Services, Services for Macintosh, Internet Connection Sharing, Internet Connection Firewall. etc., and much other.
That's not many things.
That's a lot of stuff. It doesn't work.
On a relative basis. I mean,
on a relative basis.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they go into depth.
A number of products floating around.
Yeah. Well, they go into depth as to what the source of the problem is, and apparently the source of the problem is much of Windows software was written with 32-bit longs, and that's just not going to work on a 64-bit architecture without some porting. And, of course, that's true also in Linux, but Linux is also, even the 32-bit world, has a little more adaptability, and the standards are a little bit different. And so here we go on to my next link, and this is from eWeek. On the sidebar, SUSE Ready's Linux upgrade for 64-bit. And here we go. Their latest 9.0 and upcoming 9.1 SUSE Linux professional and personal will include, I guess, support for the 64-bit. And the personal will be $30-$40 and the professional will be $80 and professional version for AMD 64-bit architecture will cost $120. And this is pretty cheap considering what Microsoft's going to be offering. You know, they're talking huge amounts of money. This is a good sidebar in the InfoWorld piece called Overcoming Awful Performance, AWE.
Well, yeah, if we can backtrack to your previous story before we go too far afield.
Yeah.
A conversation came up late last week about Server 2003 and it going to market with so many holes in it. And one of the people I was talking to had actually sat down with a bunch of engineers from Microsoft, and there's publicly admitted to holes, and there's other things that they don't want to talk about. They may actually have to backtrack to an old schema to salvage the situation with 2003 server that they used, a trick that they used back in the days of Win9X. Do you remember what thunking is?
Oh yeah, thunking. Yeah, that's where you turn a 32-bit machine into a 16-bit machine by rebooting it on the fly.
Yep, you have two separate versions of the operating system in reserved memory.
Yep. One is a 16-bit, one's a 32-bit, and you thunk down, and that's what makes Windows 95, Windows 98, and Windows 9 ME such a pleasure to run.
Yeah, that's why there's all those errors in there.
Yeah.
But you know, even with all the errors, it actually did work as a patch for the issue of legacy software. And so they may have to do something like thunking to get the situation worked out with 2003. It'll be interesting to watch. Definitely a product they started to release way before it was ready.
Listen, folks, Linux doesn't thunk.
Well, that's a very quotable quote right there.
Yes, it is. That's great.
The SUSE looks pretty good, and at price point, they're going to sell a few of those AMD things at $120 a pop. If I had to market for a 64-bit architecture, I would go with the AMD, and I would probably go back to SUSE then because that's a very good price, and at that price I can support SUSE with that. That's great. They're a good company anyway.
Yeah, AMD is on track to beat the crap out of Intel in that market. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Oh well, you know they've got the two 64-bit architectures.
Yeah,
you know they got the Opteron and the
Linus, by the way, on the boat said he likes AMD 64-bit and he likes PowerPC too. He's not real fond of Intel.
Yep. Well, the G5 is cleaning up the Mac market. I'll tell you right now that it's a sweet machine.
Well, they can't keep up with it. Try and get one of the dual processors.
Yeah,
it's hard to do.
About $3,000 though. Not bad price for that.
It's zero if you can't get it.
in related news, and I don't have a link on this one, but I read the other day that that HP is all but made it official. The Alpha is dead. Yeah,
it's now the Omega.
Couldn't see that coming.
Yeah, well, you know, that came with that was we saw that coming with Compaq's purchase of digital equipment. Right, Russ?
Yeah.
As, don't get me started on that one.
Dorothy Parker said when Calvin Coolidge died, how could they tell?
But you know what happened? What happened? One of the reasons that the AMD chips are so cool is because they hired a bunch of the Alpha engineers to do their design work.
There you go.
The way you can tell is if you look at the pinout and electrical specs on I think it's the Athlon, or maybe it's the Palomino version. At least one of the Athlon versions actually uses the EV7 bus from the Alpha.
It looks remarkably similar to the Alpha. It really does. Suspiciously similar.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons the AMD chips rock so hard. They, in effect, they got a lot of the Alpha expertise on their team.
And on a similar theme, I'm not going to talk about this, but a link we actually had up from last week talking about the 64-bit Athlon, there is a Linux CD distro, runs right off the CD, that takes a Athlon 64-bit system and turns it into the ultimate gaming console on anabolic steroids.
Wee doggy.
So we've got a link to that article. The article is actually a couple weeks old, but I think it's a story of merit. If you're really into gaming, you can get a copy of the CD distro and run some games at just outrageous speed. So.
I'm going to the computer fair in Pomona this weekend again, and last time I went, which was 3 weeks ago, there were a few Opterons. The big 64-bit. There was Opterons all over the place, 64-bit, but the high-end stuff were they had some to show, but they didn't have any to sell yet.
Mm-hmm.
But there were 64-bit Opteron all over the place, and at really good prices.
And the interesting thing about that is I've talked to a couple of people who tell me that you don't actually need a fully tuned 64-bit distribution to get a lot of benefit out of those chips. What you can do is get a stock distribution and then compile your own kernel in 64-bit mode.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently you get most of the benefit of having a fully 64-bit compiled distribution just by doing that.
And then you go to the cutting-edge kernel and get the 2.6 upgrade, and then you're really flying.
Yeah. Ain't we got fun.
But we
ain't we got fun.
But we have to pay score license fee for that.
yet. I have one more story.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Bite your tongue.
And this one's a really dandy. This one is in CRN. It's called Custom Notebooks. Toshiba adopts build-to-order program for solution providers. Nice idea. Where you can will offer exclusive custom-built notebook configurations for U.S. solution providers as part of its new channel strategy. This has Linux written all over it.
Where is this?
CRN Magazine. The link should be on the site.
It's not yet. We'll get it there, though.
Okay.
And this is really good.
Does it mention Linux?
No. You got to read between the lines. It's on two pages here. It doesn't say Linux, but you know we're talking. You know, unless I can't believe that they would offer custom hardware configurations and then not have custom software as well.
I'm real interested in getting hard data on this, but everybody I've spoken to who's willing to speak off the record has said that all of the OEMs, Toshiba included, are so deeply in bed with Microsoft. What they're waiting on is, and that includes Intel, by the way, which still hasn't released the Linux drivers for Centrino, have they? I don't think so.
Not yet, no.
No. And there are mixed reports on whether or not they exist. Linus told me he's heard it both ways. But there's this chicken and egg thing where they say they're waiting for market demand. But the story is they're waiting for one really huge customer, you know, a Walmart or a GM or a Boeing to say,
Boeing.
Yeah, to say, hey, look, okay, we want 50,000 laptops, and we want them soon, and let these guys fight over it, and force the device drivers to start getting developed back in the channel, and fix ACPI and other.
And you know where I think they might get that order?
Huh?
You know where I think they might get that order? The state of Massachusetts.
What a possibility.
You know, Boeing. You mentioned Boeing, and I was gonna say Boeing sounds like a good target for that. But Boeing has been a heavy Unix user for long.
For a long time. Part of what it's going to take is, and one of the guys I spoke to was explaining to me that an awful lot of what happens in the laptop space, and the reason they're not white box laptops, has to do with the proprietary graphics drivers from ATI and NVIDIA, where a Toshiba or a Sony or an Apple or somebody like that, along with, in the case of the latter, Microsoft, will work with those guys to come up with the electronics that allow, for example, you to put a DVD in the drive of your laptop and not have it hit the CPU and just relate directly to the graphics driver. And that doesn't, you know, we don't have that on a Linux box yet. But it will happen if we have the demand for it. So that's
we've got video for Linux. That's pretty close.
Huh?
A video for Linux is pretty close.
Yeah.
And I can report that Zine recently seems to have passed the doesn't suck threshold.
Well,
it was sort of almost there for a long time. Now I'm actually finding it usable.
Hmm. MPlayer, I've been using MPlayer. MPlayer is very usable if you can suffer the attitude of the developers, which seems to have gotten better, by the way. Zine is actually a nicer looking app, and although MPlayer does allow you to use Zine skins, but Zine unfortunately has this attitude that we're not going to break the DMCA.
It's not hard to find where to upload the libraries.
Yeah, they don't make it easy, though.
Yeah. The biggest problem I have with Zine is the skins. They're all designed for a much lower resolution screen than I have.
I agree.
They're designed for something like 72 DPI screens. So when I bring them up, the fancy skins that they've created to look like a consumer electronics appliance, the legends on them are all too small to read.
Right. Right.
Yeah, same thing with mine. Like, I mean, I end up having to use some dumb thing that you know, just so I can read MPlayer.
Sigh.
What can you say?
Yeah. Well, there is, in the part of the people I've spoken to, some faith. And if anybody knows anything here, please contact me, because I want to cover this subject for Linux Journal. But, you know, that Intel's not going to move. Nobody wants to cross Microsoft in this one. They just don't want to do it.
Yeah, but yet on the other hand, if we now look at the PDA space, the handheld device space, they're tripping over each other to come out with a Linux PDA.
It doesn't matter. The PDA is dead.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. But I don't entirely go along with that, Eric.
Actually, when I saw that Economist article, I mean, I've been thinking the same thing for quite a while now. Part of the reason was my own experience of having tried to use a couple of PDAs, and they're useless. The reason they're useless is because here I end up with this lump of information that I have on my PDA that's very difficult to get anywhere else. I can't swap contact information with my cell phone. I can't easily do it with my computer. It's just too much of a pain.
Right. Yeah,
that's why
it's like having a small printer in your pocket. I mean,
yeah, it makes a neat toy if you're into geek toys, but once you actually try and use them for anything, it's like, why bother?
The cool thing right now, the coolest PDA I've seen, the only one that's made me want to covet one anyway, is a Palm with a Garmin GPS thingy in it. Because I love GPS.
And a cell phone so everybody can tell where you are. Hey, yeah. We get one, Doc, and we'll be able to get
yeah,
connected.
You can run me down.
Yeah, that's it.
You can put the crosshairs right on top of me. I sat next to it, quite coincidentally, when I rode back from Denver, I was sitting next to a guy who turned out to be, you know, a local heavy-duty Linux geek whose mom I knew when she was the mayor of a town up in the Bay Area a long time ago. Anyway, he's a cool guy, and he had a GPS with him. And he was sitting on the aisle seat, and he could still tell where the hell we were. He could still see three satellites out the window. And it was pretty damned amazing. It blew my mind. I mean, here we are saying you're, you know, 37,500 feet traveling, you know, west-southwest at, you know, 600 miles an hour, and here are the roads below. It was so freaking cool.
Yeah.
You know, so I think tying that in with your contact base and your calendar, I think, is not a bad thing. And suddenly adding geo to those other two directories makes some kind of sense to me. If you're
yeah.
if you're looking for limited functionality,
have you seen the Korean PDA, the Yapi?
No, I've heard of it, and it's
very,
I know it's Linux based.
Very cool.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Cool.
It was several years ago. I covered it.
The issue that Eric addressed is part of what they're going after.
Uh-huh.
Is trying to get a database that can be migrated from handheld device to handheld device to handheld device. And in addition to that, they've come up with some very, very clever ways of integrating the Yapi with a desktop. And the approach they've taken in their second generation device is extremely clever, in that they've got a terminal server built into the damn PDA and have a little web interface that you plug it into your desktop machine, and you access the PDA with a web interface.
Oh, of course, that's obviously the right way to do it.
And that you integrate your two databases together using that method.
Heck, we do that with Linksys routers nowadays.
Right.
Why not PDAs?
Right, exactly. And it's a very clever little device. Hopefully, I'm going to have one about 2 weeks to play around with.
Now, the question I have in my mind is, why doesn't my cell phone do that?
Yeah.
I got all this phone number and contact information that's on my cell phone, and it's stranded there. If I want to get it anywhere else, I have to copy it out manually.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Or type it in everywhere.
Yeah.
What I do is I don't use much contact information from my Zoris. I use that for calendar and for basically getting network access. The Zoris is an amazing network access tool. I just pop my Wi-Fi card in, and I can get onto my network from anywhere within one house of my my network here.
Yep.
It's really great.
I give the Zoris props for actually having something resembling a keyboard that doesn't suck too horribly.
No, it doesn't suck too horribly. And you can virtually load any Linux software on it and basically run just about anything you like. And recently I put on the Kismet Sniffer, and it doesn't take any prisoners.
Ironically enough,
Kismet on a Zoris is very cool.
It
just works.
I bought two Sharp Zoruses, neither of which I own. I bought them both for overseas Linux friends who couldn't get them direct, because apparently they won't sell the model that everybody wants overseas. So.
Yes, I think that's true. In fact, there's a couple of the versions we can't buy here in the States. So.
Yeah, the one with the keyboard and screen and the proper directions only available in Japan.
Yep.
The C700 series.
Yes. Yeah, it's really hard to get here. Well, let's get back on theme here.
There's a theme?
Yeah, well, tonight's topic is not PDAs, but we'll do a show on PDAs in a couple weeks. Eric, before we totally run out of time, I presume you called to talk about your book.
I called to talk about whatever was going on, but since you don't have any burning topics, I'll talk about my book.
I do have burning topics, but you're here, so talk about your book.
Have they burned down yet? Yeah.
Sure. It's called The Art of Unix Programming. It's just recently hit the bookstores, like within the last couple days. It's doing real well. It was actually up to Amazon rank 218 today. It isn't quite that high now, but lots of people are buying it. The reviews are really good. You're right, Jeff. It is an unusual book because it tries to be a book that talks about design rather than the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts of code.
Yep. It's not a syntax book at all.
No, I was deliberately not aiming there. The world has a lot of books about how to do shell tricks, about the details of accessing CAPIs. The world has a lot of introductions to Unix. It has a lot of introductions to Linux. That's not the book I thought we needed. The book I thought we needed was a book that would help people get a look inside the design tradition of Unix, how it is that people who are expert Unix programmers think, how they approach problems, how they decompose difficult design challenges, what is it about the Unix way of thinking that makes it special. And that's what this book is about.
Yes, also reads like in a lot of ways like a history volume.
Yeah, that's sort of my personal style. I'm fascinated by the causes of things, so I tend to fill in a lot of background that other people might omit. Besides, I think it makes a more interesting story that way.
Yep. Yeah. So far, I've gotten maybe 5 chapters in. So far, it's a lot of fun to read, which is there in itself. Separates it away from a technical manual. It's not in that way a technical manual. But
Eric,
yeah,
there's been a huge number of Unix books published over the history of Unix, and there's several that stand out that are good, really great programming books for Unix.
Mm-hmm.
One I can think of is Programming Pearls by John Bentley in his update. Is that where you kind of see your book?
The books I would like this one to be on the shelf next to are things like Kernighan and Pike's The Unix Programming Environment.
Yes, I've got that. It's a great book.
The Practice of Programming, Kernighan and somebody else whose name I don't remember at the moment. Andrew Thomas and Dave Hunt's The Pragmatic Programmer. These are all books that are about how to think like an expert engineer, like an experienced engineer. And that's where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I'd throw in a little bit of 25 years of Unix into that mix, too.
Although the trouble with a quarter century of Unix is it's this huge, wonderful brain dump of facts, which is wonderful if you're already interested in the history of the field. But unfortunately, Peter didn't make a lot. He doesn't seem to think like a systematist. He didn't make a lot of effort to discern and pick out large-scale patterns in those facts. So that's a book that you mine for interesting information, but if you want analysis, you have to go elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
I have to say, too, it's just full of lucid writing, which, Eric, you're so good at. I mean, you just open it at random, and there's a sentence like this: the mass marketing of the Internet both increased the pool of potential developers and lowered the transaction cost of distributed development. I mean, it just nails shit. I mean, it's just good shit. I mean, there's... You do good, buddy. You do good at this stuff.
I have a talent for stating the obvious.
Yeah, but in quotable ways, I mean, it's in ways that are intelligent and make you think. Which, as usual, there's a lot of here.
And the people this book is particularly addressed to, I had 3 audiences in mind. One is, for the last 5 years, I've sensed that there are a lot of fledgling Linux programmers out there, kids in their teens and 20s, who have a really strong sense that there's something very powerful, very wise, almost in a weird way, sort of almost sacred, about the Unix tradition. But they sense that, and they want it, but they haven't been able to get it because nobody had written it down for them. There have only been a few sporadic attempts to talk about the philosophical level of Unix. Mike Gankar's The Unix Philosophy was one. Kernighan and Pike's The Unix Programming Environment sort of went there on another level. And the thing is, most of these books are really old. The Unix Programming Environment, which I think is the best effort so far to sort of get at the Unix philosophy, well, the last edition of that was in 1984, and there's been a lot of stuff happen since then. The Internet, the rise of graphics, for Christ's sake, the thousandfold fall in computing costs since then. There haven't been too many attempts to do this, so those kids out there, they wanted it, but they couldn't get it. I wrote this book. The single audience I had most in mind was for those kids who want to understand what it is that's powerful, what it is that's magic about the whole Unix thing.
Yeah, I really think, Eric, that the volume, at least from the first 5 chapters, I really think that this has an opportunity, if marketed well by your publisher, to become a textbook for an introduction to programming class?
I'm working on a teaching guide. We do have some college-level courses in mind. I think where it would actually fit in the best is in an intermediate to advanced course on software engineering. Of course, it could also be a core text for a course focused on Unix, but a lot of the book is about software engineering, and my exercises focus even more on that.
Yep.
Now, I did have a couple other audiences in mind. One is you'll notice that there's a lot more stuff about parallels with Windows and other operating systems than is normally in a Unix book. I did that very deliberately because I wanted this book to be useful to experienced programmers from other traditions, from other operating systems, who already know how to write C code, already understand about data structures and algorithms and stuff like that, and they also want to get what is it that's significant about Unix. Maybe they're developing under Linux for the first time. It would be nice if they were able to speak the local idiom, as it were, if they were able to adopt some of the successful thought patterns of Unix developers. Be a lot fewer culture clashes that way.
How much do I've not seen the book yet, Eric. I'm sorry. How much do you go into the API in that?
The Unix API itself?
Yeah.
Hardly at all. What I talk a lot more about, except in one area, I do talk about the API for inter-process communication a bit, because there's so many different IPC methods knocking around inside Unix. But I don't really talk about the API level in general much at all. I focus more on things like why Unix file formats look the way they do, why application protocols look the way they do, why people use particular conventions for command line switches and don't use others. Under what circumstances should you think about writing a filter? Under what circumstances should you think about writing something with a compiler-like interface? How do GUIs and command line interface programs fit together in a way that uses the strengths of both?
Which is what the Unix philosophy is all about,
mm-hmm.
Compartmentalize and conquer.
And a lot of the book is about tactics for keeping things simple, because that is the great Unix virtue, keeping things simple, effective minimalism.
Programming Pearls touches on that one.
Yeah.
That's an
yeah.
old book, too, but that's a great one. It's an essential book. It's on my shelf.
I agree. Bentley did a lot of good writing about that kind of thing from deep inside the Unix tradition. I'm not sure that I think he did a lot to make that accessible to people from outside that tradition, though.
That's true. Yeah.
You already had to be fairly familiar with C and Unix before you could see where he was coming from.
Yep.
He does a lot of scripting, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, Eric, we do need to move along because I see Evan is already on the phone. Hello, Evan.
Okay, I'll stop ranting now.
And so what we're going to do is we're going to take a break and get ourselves situated for a segment number two. You can hang around, Eric. You don't need to.
I was more or less intending to.
And so we'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes with part two of the Linux Show for October the 21st, 2003. Everybody hang in there. We'll be right back. Put on a tune, Kevin.
And we're back.
This is the Linux Show, part two. It sounds like we're going to have a good second segment because the dialogue going on during the break is already pretty exciting. So we got a long, old-time friend of the show calling in tonight, Evan from LPI, Linux Professional Institute. I don't know how many times you've been on the show. At least three or four times.
Well, it's been fun. The ZDNet gig isn't happening anymore, but I've been keeping busy otherwise.
You've always got your head into all kinds of things. But let's talk a little while just about LPI and their, I don't know if it's fair to say, core mission, at least one of their more publicly recognized core missions of creating testing matrix. Metrics and promoting a professional standard within the Linux community, which itself is a controversial issue. What is new in terms of the state of the LPI exam 2? Is it fully flushed out now?
Well, the exam program was meant to be in three phases, level one, level two, level three. Level one, level two are still going pretty strong. Been translated into Japanese, and by the end of this year should also be in Chinese, Portuguese, and German. The international demand for this has just been absolutely staggering. The neat thing is that we continue to get new friends. Companies like Novell have been coming on, and in a big way. IBM's got plans to get 2,000 people certified over a single weekend. So there's been some very interesting things happening with the certification. In terms of the sort of R&D, if you would, with it moving on, level 3 is under development, and level 1 is undergoing some continuous tweaking, mainly at a security level to prevent things like brain dumps. We've got some other things on the go. They're fairly major projects, but they're much more long-term. They involve a desktop certification that we announced at Linux World in August that has started to just get underway. And the other one is an international testing network to supplement what we've been doing so far. Our goal is to be able to do a hands-on computer test anywhere in the world for about $20.
Very
different from what's existed so far.
I think that in itself is very exciting. I have been, of course, she's a local girl, so to speak. She's a Midwest girl. Kara Pritchard, I'm constantly in contact with Kara. She and I subscribe to a number of the same lug list. And she has been keeping me apprised of this target that you've been working on of this $20 certification test, which I think is marvelous. And I think it's also cool that so many people like Kara are taking it into the field and offering, at least she offered to the local groups here in the Midwest, that if anybody can get together a group of 20 people or more, she'll be there to help set up some LPI testing.
Yeah, and in fact, that's not just a local phenomenon. That's happening pretty well all over the place. A couple of months ago, I delivered some myself in Hanoi. We've done a whole bunch in Brazil, and we're scheduled to do a whole bunch of exams like that in South Africa in January. The intent, of course, is to try and put together a network so it doesn't depend on people from us flying down there, but literally to make the local community able to administer the exam to their local community.
Well, I just want you to know this. This is totally. I've told Kara that I was going to tell you this, but I haven't made any efforts to promote this prior to this moment. But the Linux Show is throwing its support behind the LPI to the extent that I have acquired the support of Northwestern Business College to be a testing center for you. Whenever you want to have one of these events, just give me a call, and the college will be willing to provide you with facilities free of cost.
That's extremely cool. Thank you.
So, well, hey, you know, you guys are doing the effort. The least we can do is help you, you know. And at $20 a test, you know, in order to be able to do that, you need to have some support from facilities to make it affordable. If you're ending up paying, you know, a couple $1,000s to rent a lab for a day, you're not going to be able to do that kind of thing. So.
Yeah. The project, which we're calling ZAMNET, actually has two elements of it, the technical end and the human end. The technical end is going to be a whole examination engine open sourced so that it'll be usable not only by LPI, but we're hoping that the community will be able to make use of it so that any university that wants to do computer-based testing within their own organization can use the software to be able to deliver it. We want to be able to do the kind of hands-on testing that we know the Red Hat certification program has been able to do. The problem with that is it's not extremely scalable to, you know, to either low cost or a large number of delivery cities. And so, part of what we want to do with this network is to situate it so that, say, question one is multiple choice, question two is multiple choice, question three pops up a screen and says, okay, set the IP address. For a junior level, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes it really stand out as opposed to just more multiple choice. We're absolutely committed to doing that in a very scalable and low-cost way.
Yep. Have you talked to anybody within either the School Forge or SUL organization?
Yeah, we've been involved with the SUL folks, Doug Loss and folks. They're very aware of what we're up to. School Forge, not quite as much. There's a whole bunch of organizations in a number of different countries that we're working with, there's a couple of countries, in fact, that have volunteered themselves as test beds for this. The human element of this is going to be even more difficult to do than the technical end because there's a security aspect. It's very important that employers and contractors trust the results of the exam, and that means that the person that signs up to get the certificate is the one taking the exam. That may sound quite trivial in some places, but there's an awful lot of countries on Earth where it is not.
Well, it's more than just that. You've got two sides to that issue when you're talking about the complexity of security for testing, because not only do you have to have a secure test, but at least here in the United States, when you're talking to educators, you've got something called the Family Security Act that you have to deal with, which is a whole set of regulations that grade schools, high schools, colleges have to deal with in terms of making sure that scores of students do not leak outside of the networks of the schools themselves. The liability that schools are facing right now is pretty frightening in terms of...
Well, I understand what you're saying, and on one hand, we have tried to have a fairly strong privacy policy on that and make sure that the only people that have access to certification info are the people that are certified and people that they explicitly permit.
Yep.
But one thing that's worth adding to this is that the IT industry, by and large, has been getting a bit of a free ride because it really doesn't have the respect of the education field per se because it's so vendor-specific and vendor-driven. There's a lot of things that people seem to accept in the world of IT, especially in education, that they would simply not accept in just about any other field of society. And the best and quickest analogy I can give of that is if people were told that they had to get their driver's license from Ford, most people would not accept that kind of a premise, and yet people accept it all the time in IT.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Couldn't agree with you more on that one.
And, in fact, part of the reason why LPI was formed in the first place was to try and increase the level of professionalism and the amount of respect that IT gets within society, because right now it just isn't on the same level as other professions. And part of that is because things have been so dominated by vendors and have become so much of a marketing machine as opposed to an educational issue that society just doesn't have respect for it. And in our own little way and in our own speed, in our own way, we're trying to fix that.
You know, I just want to throw this in here for a second. This is Doc. One of the things that I've been looking at Linux Journal for almost the last year, we've had a series that we're calling How Linux Helps Make Smart Companies Smarter. That just runs headlong against the culture of vendor centrism that's going on. There's yet another, somebody pointed me to yet another conference next spring on Linux in IT, and it's all vendors. And yet, when I talk to people on the inside, it's so clear that it's the customers that are leading the vendors and not vice versa.
Yeah, Doc, you just handed me an interesting rhetorical weapon. In the future, I think I'm going to start talking about vendor-centric versus user-centric computing.
Absolutely. It's just a huge thing. It's a huge thing. And I've never seen as big a disconnect as we have right now between the what's passing for common wisdom, especially with analysts the likes of Gartner, which has something stupid to say almost on a weekly basis about this, but also the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, it'll say ridiculous things like, you know, HP and IBM are driving Linux in the enterprise. It's not true.
Well, we certainly
appreciate their role, but it's just they're not driving things. No, they're being led. There's a new ecology here that's a lot more like a real marketplace, and it's not supplier-driven. You know, the demand side is supplying itself, thank you very much, and that's what's coming out of this.
Well, anyway. Another thing that we run into with LPI is that people tend to equate us, because we have multi-vendor support, as being vendor-neutral in the same kind of way as, say, a CompTIA is vendor-neutral, in which it's, okay, there's more than one vendor, but it's still just vendors. And sometimes we have to go out of our way to make the point to analysts and media that we started out as a community body that incidentally has vendor support, but we didn't start out as a vendor body. And there's lots of people that just, it's such a culture shock.
Yeah, their brains shut down.
It's very hard to accept, and yet it's the most, in other more mature industries, the one I always bring up is construction because it's the oldest one, but also because we borrow a lot of our vocabulary from it. It goes without saying that the vendors are you know, a necessary but highly insufficient condition to having a marketplace here. You know, most of the work that's done is project work done by crews on specific jobs where you call on various forms of building material that are extremely handy. Now, Linux fits that bill. So does the rest of the LAMP suite. And inside IT, there are plenty of companies that'll tell me, you know, look, we're having a great time here. We're doing all kinds of neat stuff, and we're leading the vendors. We just can't talk about it. We just can't talk about it.
There is an organization called NOCA, based in Washington, the National Organization of Competency Assurance. In a nutshell, they certify certifications, and their members are nursing associations, engineering societies, occupational therapy, heavy equipment operators, and so on. And what they do is they review the credentials, partially for government acceptance, but partially also for, you know, maintaining a certain kind of standard. There's not a single IT certification in the bunch.
Wow.
Including CompTIA.
Including CompTIA. And, right now, LPI is looking to, and we're working on being essentially the first IT certification that they have going through their gauntlet.
Thank goodness.
We're about 80% of the way there, and we look ready to be able to do it by early spring.
Yeah.
Well,
anybody who seriously says CompTIA and vendor neutral in the same breath. Seriously, you got
to. Well, they are vendor neutral, but it is all just vendors. And we, in fact, have discarded the term vendor neutral in regarding to LPI, and use the term vendor independent.
Well,
that's a really good distinction.
Sorry,
that's a very good distinction, actually.
It's not enough to be vendor neutral.
You know, one of the things that I also get is that there is in the ecology of the marketplace out there, there are lots of independent vendors. You know, I mean, we're talking about the smaller guys, you know, the ones that live in one niche or another. And they're feeling very much out of the out of the press loop, even though that they often stand in a kind of intermediary and enabling position between the independent enterprise and the large, formerly, I should say, dominant vendors. So I really like the term independent. I think it's a timely and good one.
But when you're talking about some of the small computer vendors that you're talking about, there's a lot of membership within groups like CompTIA from these small VARs and so on. And most of them are deathly scared of open source because, I mean, there's no value add in their VAR. They make most of their money selling licenses, and they're feeling very threatened.
Well, then they should go out and learn a skill.
Yeah, there are some interesting cases out there too. Evan, I'd love to talk just offline or on the phone in the next couple of days if you're up for that.
Well, Evan, I know there's another topic you want to talk about.
It has to do with something that we got involved in as part of some fundraising efforts, and we find ourselves as one of only two open source groups being representing, sort of flying the flag, so to speak, at very possibly the biggest international IT conference in the last decade. It's called the World Summit on the Information Society and takes place in mid-December in Geneva. It is going to be a conglomeration of just about every country on Earth sending a delegation trying to make some kind of coherent global IT policy. As well, there's about 2,000 non-governmental organizations in just about every field from, the Red Cross to ecology groups. And in this large worldwide conference that's supposed to be talking about setting a global IT policy and statement of principles, and the only folks that are pretty well flying the flag is going to be us and the Free Software Foundation.
Okay, and Richard will be there, huh?
Yeah, he's already very well involved.
Yeah, I betcha.
They have a subgroup on what started to be called intellectual property, but the people that got involved in that disagreed with the term intellectual property, so it's now the subgroup on patents, copyrights, and trademarks. And they've been pretty involved in trying to encourage the countries to adopt a policy, of course, that encourages free software, especially encourages free standards that are unencumbered by patents and so on, which is sometimes a hard thing to get people to wrap their heads around. I come across a lot of people whose idea of a free standard is a patented one that is given away freely, and they just don't understand. But we're giving you access to the patent for free. Isn't that open enough? And they just don't get it.
Yeah, it still has a legal encumbrance on it, and that's not entirely satisfactory.
Not to mention the fact that freedom can be revoked at any time at the whim of the owner.
Yeah, until the patent expires.
As well as the rights of derivative works. That's the biggie.
Yeah, that's the biggie.
Anyway, so this conference is going to be going on. We actually are going to have a booth on the floor of the trade show associated with this conference. Right down there with groups such as the United Nations Development Program, the World Bank, and so on. So we actually have 10 people coming in from LPI and its affiliates in Germany, Brazil, and North America who are going to be getting together and trying to put our best foot forward. To most of the people there, this is going to be the only Linux booth, so we're preparing to ask every question from what is grub to what is SourceForge and so on.
Do any of your people have speaking slots?
We're working on that right now. The speaking regimen is going to be very strange. What we're trying right now to do is to set up a couple of workshops. There's a lot of groups that are going to be there who are going to be encouraging governments to use open source and adopt open source as policy. LPI's main goal once they're there and curious and interested is to provide a resource through workshops and other things to actually help people to get them to implement things and to understand what they're working with. It's also our intention right now to put a Linux CD in the hand of every delegate that shows up there.
There you go. Which have you decided which
we
which
have
one?
Offers right, we have offers right now from SUSE and to probably do one based on Morphix funded by a major two-lettered computer company.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. Morphix, of course, being the Canopix fork.
Right. Well, this is actually done with the full blessing, cooperation, and help of people at the top of the Debian project.
Which is a Debian release.
We definitely want to have something that would make a very good demo system that you wouldn't need to touch your hard disk. And so SUSE is making available to us a live CD, and Debian is making available to us a version of Morphix that we're going to customize ever so slightly to provide some resources to the people that show up at the conference.
LPI should look at using those bootable live CDs as part of their testing regimen. That would be a good platform to base a custom thing on.
We have all sorts of plans for what we're going to be doing long term in terms of developing that that testing structure. It involves things like end user Linux to be able to create and tear down individual sessions as each question is delivered. So the tech folk who are involved in doing that, and I certainly don't pretend to speak for them, appear to have that kind of thing well in hand.
People, this reminds me, interesting topic for a future show. There's been an earthquake happen in the Linux distributions world recently that a lot of people haven't assimilated yet, and that is Fedora. The implications of Fedora, they are big, 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 big.
Yep.
Fedora being a Red Hat.
Yep.
But the really interesting thing is that there is now a prospect of there being one single canonical RPM registry that you can incrementally update from with apt-get. The implications of this are huge. Huge.
So this would bring together the package management.
Well, among other things, I think it's going to destroy the ecological niche within which a lot of Red Hat derivative distributions like CRUD and even Mandrake have been operating. What we now have is the prospect of a world in which there is a Red Hat distribution that is as easy to update incrementally as Debian has been traditionally.
Yeah, Debian's just two commands.
This is a big deal.
Yep. Evan, I've got a couple of questions for you. We do have a worldwide audience here. And so I've been getting a couple of questions passed off to me from various people from around the world asking, how do they get information on this conference?
The conference is, the best way is to do a Google search on the letters WSIS. And it's actually being cooperatively run by the United Nations and the International Telegraph Union. And so it's actually one of the rare domains that ends with .int. I can try and call it up, but essentially right now doing a search on WSIS in Google will point anyone to that site in a hurry.
Okay. And where is this conference being held?
Geneva.
Geneva.
It's called the PAL Expo, which is the main conference center in Geneva. It's attached right to the Geneva airport.
Okay. That's not too bad. Flying to Geneva is not too expensive.
Geneva is phenomenally expensive.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh, I have the website here. It is www.itu.int/WSIS.
Okay. People can go there and look up information. Okay, anything else you want to talk about this evening pertaining to LPI or...
Oh, well, we've got our hands full with those things. I mean, we don't consider ourselves an advocacy group, but to a certain extent, we may have no choice being, one of only two groups flying the flag there. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see how that comes out. And especially a lot of the backroom politics, where essentially you have just about every country in the world except one that's pushing in the direction of greater acceptance of open source, and one that's pushing back extremely hard.
So what's your read on why that is? Who's got a lock on the U.S.'s representatives and how?
Well, put it this way. How many countries in the world do you figure are net exporters of software licenses?
Yeah.
You know, take a trip down to Sao Paulo, and they're talking on the order of $400 million a year going out just in license fees.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking at a certain level. This is not just this is not an issue of any particular software vendor. At a certain level, this becomes a very macro balance of trade kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so you have certain interests that believe they have an awful lot to lose. If the amount of dependency is reduced, especially by countries in the third world, and in fact, a lot of what's supposed to be going on at this Geneva conference is intended to try and reduce the technology gap and reduce the amount of dependence that the developing world has on external resources. And really, open source is the only way that they can really free themselves of that kind of dependence. Other groups like the FSF are going to advocate that that's what they should do, and once they're there, it's LPI's job in part to show them how. I mean, our focus is on standards and education, and you know, those are the cores on which everything else can be built.
Very interesting.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to figure out if there's a way we can slide it into the budget to make a field trip to Geneva this December.
Why don't we broadcast live?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Maybe the whole crew.
Maybe I could.
Well,
find
there's
it.
Actually going to be a separate subconference there on media access in the Information Society, so there'll certainly be a lot of place for you.
Yep. Yep. All we have to do is come up with a sponsor or two.
Or five.
Yeah. Or
yeah.
Yep. Oh, we'll see what we can do. That sounds really like an important conference to show up to.
Well, if it's mostly as dominated by NGOs, as you say, then the FSF is probably the right group to have there. Their sort of vague aura of leftism will appeal to that crowd.
Yeah, I agree.
Of that, you can have absolutely no doubt.
Yes.
What is it question, though, is whether or not the sum total of those NGOs is going to have any effect of the outcome of the actual action plan and statement of principles, which, like I said, is the subject of a tug of war purely between the national delegations.
I see. And it's not clear what kind of pitch will appeal most to the national delegations.
Right now, I think the pitch has already worked. We've received back comments from LPI affiliates from Brazil and Japan and Germany that those countries, their national representatives are already heavily in favor of putting in more open source, not only within government, but as a societal shift.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of what happens at this conference, they're going to be going in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so we know that a lot of countries, not only developing countries, but developed ones, are going to be pushing for open source, and the only question at this point is whether or not they're going to carry the day in a consensus document, or whether the pushback is going to be so strong that it guts everything out of it.
Well, it's an interesting question, especially since the motivation that a lot of the more developed countries have for getting behind this shift is not one they want to talk about in public. Which is, and I know this is true in Norway and in Germany at minimum. I suspect it's true all over all through the Group 8 countries in Europe and also in Japan. They don't want any NSA backdoors in their software, and they're terrified with some reason that when you do things like finding spare cryptographic key slots in Microsoft Office suites that are actually labeled NSA, then that pretty much tells you what they're there to be used for. So there's actually a fair amount of pressure on, I know at minimum this is true, again, as I said, of Norway and Germany, there's a fair amount of pressure from their own internal security people, their own counter-espionage people, to get closed source the hell out of their government because they can't trust it. But this is not a motivation that the delegations are going to want to talk about because it creates ripples in the diplomatic stream.
Yep. There's no question. But, I mean, all of the common source reasons behind open source still apply. And the rich countries are as capable of arguing it as the poor countries. And even when you have countries such as Germany and Japan saying they don't want that kind of financial dependence,
yeah,
and dependence on their whole IT infrastructure on one country or one company, you know, the security implications are one thing, but I mean, there's all sorts of other implications in terms of just their total dependency on some outside body with no ability to control how they do their own IT.
There's a cultural autonomy issue, too, and I ran into this one pretty heavily in Korea the two times I was there. From the point of view of Korea, it's vital to them that they have software that is properly internationalized and localized for their market. The problem is, from the point of view of a big American proprietary vendor, the Korean market's too small to bother with.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the only way they're ever going to get to be able to use Hangul in their spreadsheets and so forth is if they build their own office software themselves.
Or get involved in a community project.
Right, and that's really what I'm referring to. They don't. Nope. You know, nobody has the talent to do that on their own. That's a big enough project that you basically have to have global participation, which means they need to go the open source route and contribute locally the expertise to do Korean localization.
Yep. Well, those are all very totally valid points, but there's also what I call the Balmer issue that's thrown. If you're the leader of a country, regardless of whether it is a small country, one of your A-list countries, Eric, or if it's a developing nation, I cannot, in my mind, if I was the leader of some country, want to bank the future of my nation based upon a company that has the leadership of a guy like Steve Ballmer, who is a ranting idiot.
Well, but maybe that's not visible from Malaysia or Seoul or wherever.
All you have to do is look at the front cover of CRN magazine this week, and you become very scared.
So what's on the cover?
There's only one thing on the cover of CRN magazine, and you look at it, and you can only see one thing, and that's Steve Ballmer's mug.
So what makes him any more scary than any other random overweight white corporate executive?
Well, I mean, we've all seen Steve Ballmer. He's a scary-looking dude.
Yeah, but you also have you can't count on that totally because
no, I don't think you can
with
either.
Folks like Gates, there's a lot of unspoken hero worship going on.
Yeah, I know.
There's a lot of people that secretly admire what they've done, and that's something I would
or not so secretly.
Sorry?
Or not so secretly. Consider the awful suck-up letter that we saw today from some industry pundit. Oh, Microsoft, you're so wonderful! But maybe you should consider changing your act a little bit. But you're so wonderful! You know the one I'm talking about. It was on your webpage.
Yep. Yeah, it's there's definitely that hero worship factor still comes into the equation. So.
Yeah, I would beware of assuming that any country is going to make its IT policy decisions based on not liking Steve Ballmer's mug.
Well, it's not his mug per se. It's just the people who are in charge reflect the culture of the company, and so when you've got people like Steve Ballmer and Jeff Rakes on a weekly rant, it identifies the corporate culture within Microsoft very clearly. And
yeah, but that's balanced off by people that say, well, we know the company sucks,
but
you feel like we have no choice.
Yep.
And so it is the obligation and duty of anyone who considers themselves doing open source advocacy to make sure that, you know, this is considered a credible and first-rate choice. One of the things that I did encounter in developing countries is almost a pride attitude that if they saw open source as being somehow second best, then almost as a matter of pride, they
would
want to be seen as using the second best, even if they had to pay through the nose to get the primer stuff.
Boy, I can see that being a big issue in Japan, I'll tell you.
Well, it was a big issue, for instance. I made a trip to a conference in Jamaica, where that's a country that can use open source as much, if not more, than any. And there are people there that are between fear and pride. Nobody wants to be seen as using the cheap stuff because they have to. And if it's seen as something that they can't afford to use the stuff they really want to use, so they're using open source, that's going to kill us. As long as they see that the open source stuff is every bit as good as the proprietary stuff, then there is no shame in using it, and that just opens the floodgates.
So what they need to see is a couple of high-profile deployments in the United States itself.
Well, you'd be surprised how much this City of Munich thing has done.
No, I wouldn't, actually.
It has had effect around the world.
Yeah.
A few more like it would be very nice, but just the entire story of not only how Munich made the pick, but also that they, in fact, when the last bids were brought in, that the Microsoft bid was lower, and they still went with SUSE and IBM.
Right. I can see how that would tie into what you're talking about.
And so, you know, even if Microsoft was cheaper, they still saw the benefit in the open source solution as being even worth paying a little more than that final Microsoft bid.
And then, of course, Ballmer made it worse by going back there to woo them personally and failing.
Yep. Well, the story of the Munich purchase and the multiple times it has been dissected is amongst one of the best tools that we have right now.
That's good.
A couple more major wins like that, and then there's absolutely, you know, no FUD that can undo that.
So it sounds like you're monitoring the international scene more than maybe a lot of the rest of us are. Are there any big wins of that kind that you see being imminent?
Imminent, there are at least two national governments that I know of that I can't talk about because they haven't announced it yet. But there are two G8 countries that I know of that are planning major, major open source initiatives. Whether or not they go very public about it or not, I'm not sure. But this stuff is being worked on, and they may just not be wanting to go public for fear of ruffling feathers and so on. But there are a lot of big governments that are looking to do major deployments, and some of them are starting to do test beds of what might eventually become mission-critical public databases in open source. They may be rolled out very publicly, they may not be, but this stuff is absolutely happening.
What kind of time frame are we talking? When might we see public announcements?
If they come, it would probably come within the first quarter of 2004.
Okay.
And like I say, they'd be G8 countries. Not
France.
The U.S., but definitely biggies up there.
Russia.
I'm just speculating.
Russia.
I don't know that for sure, but it sure wouldn't surprise me.
No, that wouldn't surprise me at all. France wouldn't either.
Well, except the motivations are different. I can see one set of motivations operating for basically the some of the less... some of the countries in the G8 that are having serious budget deficit problems right now.
Mm-hmm.
With France, it would probably be more like a national pride thing if it happens.
Yeah, because they're part of the infrastructure anyway, community.
Well, but that's just speculation at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
But thanks for telling us that. That's interesting data to have.
Yeah, it is interesting. Well, gentlemen, we are up to time limit of the show. And so we're going to have to shut it down for this evening. It's been a really interesting show, though. We've got lots of stories left over. We'll hold them over for next week.
Yeah, put the fedora thing on the list.
Yeah, I definitely will, Eric. But, well, thank you, Eric, and thank you, Evan, for stopping by and talking to us this evening. It's been a really very, very interesting show. And always, Evan, always keep in mind that the door is always open for you. And before we sign off for the night, you want to give the LPI website address, so if anybody wants to float you guys a donation, they can.
Well, it's www.lpi.org, and what we want from people right now is we don't want money. We just want volunteers. We want a community. We're not asking for donations from anyone except for their time.
Really? You're fully funded at this point?
We're in that fortunate position. You know, if people have something to donate right now, as far as we're concerned, their time is more valuable to us than their cash.
Ah, that reminds me. That's another story for next week. The Open Source Awards.
Okay. Okay, well, I tell you, on behalf of the whole crew here at the Linux Show, we'd like to thank those people who have been coming by every week to listen to the show, especially those who stop by the website, www.thelinuxshow.com, and throw us a donation. Unfortunately, Evan, we're not fully funded. We still are struggling on a week-to-week basis paying our phone bill, but we seem to get by with community support somehow. The people always show up and listen, and they tell their friends, and their friends listen, and it just seems to travel around the world week after week after week, and that money just seems to filter in just as the bills come due. So thanks all you people out there who have been sending in your donations. We really, really do appreciate it. Without you, the listeners of the show, we certainly wouldn't be here at all. So on behalf of the entire crew, we're going to be back in 2 weeks, not 1 week, 2 weeks. Next week is our Halloween special show, so we'll see you in 2 weeks, everybody. We are out of here. Every evening tide.